here on VOA1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Jill Robbins and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, organizers of the Tokyo Olympics say they will have measures in place next year to limit the spread of the coronavirus. The Olympics were set to take place this past summer, but were delayed until 2021 because of the virus. Little is known about how the virus affects the long-term health of individuals who are already infected, including athletes. South African researchers are leading an international effort to try to find answers. Venda Nel, a South African runner, has recovered from COVID-19, the disease caused by the virus. Nell told VOA that she is happy to be running again in preparation for the Tokyo Olympics.
It was about 2 to 4 weeks that I've took it very slowly with the training, checked my heart rate every training session, and from there I actually went into full program and I feel stronger, yeah, and actually fully recovered right now.
Martin Schwellness is a professor of sport and exercise medicine at the University of Pretoria. He directs the university's Sport, Exercise Medicine, and Lifestyle Institute. Schwellness is leading a group of scientists in setting guidelines for doctors who treat athletes recovering from serious respiratory infections, including the coronavirus. The Sport, Exercise Medicine, and Lifestyle Institute launched the International AWARE Research Study as part of this work. The project includes information from the COVID-19 Recovery Clinic for athletes. Schwellness says COVID-19 seems to affect many different organ systems.
In the returning to sport, it could result in medical complications. And to date, we don't really know what these are for COVID. And so the focus of the project is to investigate what happens in the athlete when they've had COVID and how does the body heal and respond.
The project uses an online questionnaire to gather information from any person training for 3 hours a week who had serious respiratory infections, including COVID-19. Those recovering from the disease can join the COVID-19 Recovery Clinic for help returning to sports. Michelle Yusta is both an athlete and a medical doctor. He joined the clinic after he recovered from COVID-19, which he caught from a patient. Yusta told VOA that he has done all expected of him so that he could return to training. He adds that he is required to tell doctors how he feels following physical exercise. The research examines COVID-19's effect on all organ systems. Early findings show that athletes who have had COVID-19 find low-intensity exercise to be harder and recovery time much longer than from other respiratory infections. Kelly Muller is a rehabilitation specialist at the University of Pretoria's SEMLE. She says evidence-based guidelines should help recovering athletes to better and more safely prepare for the Olympic Games.
if an athlete does happen to contract COVID-19, it would be really important and really valuable for the coaches and medical professionals to have evidence-based advice to guide that athlete back to their performance in the shortest time possible.
For Venda Nell and other athletes recovering from the infection, the research could help them come home from Tokyo as Olympic champions.
Gina Galia of Indonesia says a stranger's visit to her house led to a campaign to help students affected by the coronavirus pandemic. Galia remembers when a garbage collector came to her house in Jakarta, the Indonesian capital. The man asked if she had an old mobile phone his children could use to get on the internet. He said it does not matter if it is the ugly one, as long as his children can use it for learning from home, she said. I thought there must be many people who need second-hand mobile phones out there. Galia works for a national newspaper. Shortly after the pandemic hit Jakarta, she and 11 other journalists organized a group to provide food and money to needy people. They started hearing from parents who wanted their children to study online, but lacked a way to use the internet. Galia thought of her meeting with the garbage collector when she and her group decided to provide mobile phones to poor students. Many of these children were not able to do face-to-face learning when the new school year started in July. When the journalists announced their campaign through social media, the reaction was overwhelming. Many people donated second-hand phones, while others gave cash donations. As of November, the journalists had collected more than 200 mobile phones and donations of more than $35,000. They used the money to buy more phones. They also paid for internet use for those needing it. Currently, nearly 300 phones have been given to students in and around Jakarta, as well as to distant areas like Papua, the country's most eastern province. Helping students take part in online schooling brings happiness to Galia and her friends. We really hope the mobile phones can be used as much as they can during the pandemic, she said. Haisa Levy is a 16-year-old high school student in Depok, West Java. He now attends online classes in the morning. His father, Denny Sayuti, had been loaning his mobile phone to his son for his studies. But that meant Sayuti could only do his work as a motorcycle taxi driver for part of the day. Sayuti wrote to Galia's group in August. His family received a mobile phone a month later. Sayuti believes that his son can now do better with his online studies. Now I see him more comfortable, and he can directly reach out to his friends and teacher, Sayuti said. Chiron Ruby Almagribi had also been using his father's mobile phone to attend 3 video calls a week with his teachers and get homework. But the 11-year-old boy sometimes sent his homework late because he had to wait for his father to return from work in order to get back online. For the first time in his life, Magribi was falling behind in his studies. He also had to take care of his sick mother. This was making him feel pressured, but a big smile appeared on his face when he received the mobile phone sent by Galia's group. I will use the phone to do online school every day, McGreevy said. I'm Jill Robbins. Four astronauts arrived at the John F. Kennedy Space Center in Florida on Sunday to prepare for a trip to the International Space Station. An airplane brought the astronauts to Kennedy from the U.S. Space Agency's training center in Houston, Texas. The three Americans and one Japanese are set to leave for the ISS Saturday night, if weather conditions permit. The flight will be the second crew launch for SpaceX, a private company working with NASA to carry astronauts to space. The first SpaceX flight in May 2020 made history. It was the first time a private company had launched astronauts into Earth's orbit. SpaceX built and operated the Falcon 9 rocket and Crew Dragon spacecraft that carried two NASA astronauts to the space station. The crew, astronauts Robert Behnken and Douglas Hurley, returned to Earth in August after a 2-month stay. A Crew Dragon spacecraft carried by a Falcon 9 rocket will again transport the astronauts on the next mission. This time, the four astronauts are expected to spend about 6 months on the ISS. The crew includes Americans Michael Hopkins, Victor Glover, and Shannon Walker. Also making the trip is Soichi Noguchi of Japan's Aerospace Exploration Agency. Hopkins is a 51-year-old Air Force colonel from Missouri. He will be flying to the space station for his second time. He first traveled to the ISS in 2013 and spent a total of 166 days in space. Walker is a 55-year-old physicist from Houston. The upcoming flight will be her second trip to the space station. Her first came in 2010, when she spent 163 days in space. Walker's husband, retired NASA astronaut Andrew Thomas, helped build the ISS. Glover is a 44-year-old Navy commander from Los Angeles. This will be his first space mission. He will be the first African-American to move into the ISS for an extended stay. The 55-year-old Noguchi will be making his third trip to the space station. His longest visit came in 2010, when he spent 161 days on the ISS and served as flight engineer. Dragon will be Noguchi's third transportation vehicle for getting to space. In the past, he flew on a U.S. space shuttle and Russia's Soyuz spacecraft. The astronauts named their Dragon spacecraft Resilience to note the many challenges Americans have faced in 2020.
These include the coronavirus health crisis, protests against racial injustice, and a difficult presidential campaign season. It's been a tough year for everybody for a lot of different reasons, crew commander Mike Hopkins said after arriving in Florida. We felt like if the name of our vehicle could give a little hope, a little inspiration, put a smile on people's face, then that is definitely what we wanted to do. SpaceX officials say the company expects to launch 7 Dragons over the next 14 months, 3 to carry astronauts and 4 for transporting supplies. I'm Brian Lynn.
To help protect yourself against the new coronavirus, wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, and after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. If you cannot wash your hands with soap and water, use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Taking these steps can help prevent not only the new coronavirus disease, but also colds, flu, and other viruses. For more information, visit the following websites: the World Health Organization at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. By the summer of 1862, the American Civil War had been going on for more than a year. The Union had won some battles. The Confederacy had won others. But neither side was in a position to win the war. President Abraham Lincoln needed a major victory. He was losing the support of both politicians and the public. A major victory would not only help him that way, it would also make it easier for him to make an important announcement. For a number of months, he had been planning an announcement about the black people held as slaves in the South. Today, Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe tell about Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation.
At the end of August 1862, Confederate troops, under the command of Robert E. Lee, defeated the main Union army at Manassas, Virginia. The battlefield was less than 50 kilometers from Washington. The year before, Confederate troops had sent the Union army fleeing from that same battlefield. Now, they had done it again. With this latest victory, General Lee decided on a major move. He would carry the war into the northern states. Lee took his army of 60,000 men across the Potomac River into Maryland. He ordered some of his men to capture the Union position at Harper's Ferry. He moved the others to Sharpsburg, a town on the Potomac River. He put his men into position along Antietam Creek, just outside of town. His lines extended almost 3 kilometers. There, at Antietam, he would make his stand. He was still close enough to Virginia to withdraw if the Union force following him proved too strong.
The Union force arrived in the middle of September. it did not attack immediately. It spent one full day getting into position along Antietam Creek, across from the Confederate Army. It attacked the following day at sunrise. The Union General George McClellan planned to attack all along the Confederate line at the same time, but this did not happen. First, Union troops attacked one end of the line, which extended into a field full of tall corn plants. Then they attacked the center of the line, which was in an old, deeply sunken road that gave it good protection. Finally, they attacked at the other end of the line. For each northern attack, General Lee was able to move men to where they were needed. The northern troops got within 25 meters of the Confederate line, but they could not break through anywhere.
On the first day of battle at Antietam, Lee lost 25% of his men. On the second day, the two armies faced each other without firing. They were too tired to fight. As they rested, however, fresh Union soldiers moved into position. Lee knew they would attack with full force the next day. He knew he could not win. Sadly, he ordered his men back to Virginia. It was now clear Antietam was a northern victory. It was not a complete victory. The Union Army could have chased the Confederate Army and destroyed it. But General McClellan did not do this. He was satisfied that he had stopped the invasion.
In Washington, President Lincoln welcomed the news. He had waited a long time for a northern victory. A few days after the battle, Lincoln held a special meeting with his cabinet. He talked about the Declaration on Slavery, which he had prepared. It would free Negro slaves in the rebel states of the South. "As you remember," he said, "I put the Declaration aside several weeks ago until I could issue it supported by a military victory. The action of the army against the rebels has not been exactly what I should have liked, but the rebels have been driven out of Maryland, and Pennsylvania is no longer in danger of invasion." President Lincoln said he thought the time was right to announce the Emancipation Proclamation. The cabinet made some minor changes in the document, and Lincoln signed it.
Newspapers printed the proclamation. This is what it said.
"I, Abraham Lincoln, President of the United States and Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, do hereby declare that on the first day of January 1863, all persons held as slaves within any state then in rebellion against the United States shall then become and be forever free. The government of the United States, including the military and naval forces, will recognize and protect the freedom of such persons, and will interfere in no way with any efforts they may make for their actual freedom."
President Lincoln had tried to keep the question of slavery out of the Civil War. To him, there was just one reason for fighting: to save the Union. Nothing meant more to him than preventing the nation from splitting up. Lincoln feared that the issue of slavery would weaken the Northern war effort. Many men throughout the North would fight to save the Union. They would not fight to free the slaves. Lincoln also needed the support of the four slave states that did not leave the Union: Delaware, Kentucky, Maryland, and Missouri. He could not be sure of their support if he declared that the purpose of the war was to free the slaves. As Lincoln waited for a Union victory to announce his Emancipation Proclamation, he wrote a letter to the New York Tribune newspaper. The letter was to prepare the public for what was to come. This is what Lincoln said.
My chief object in this struggle is to save the Union. It is not either to save or destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that. What I do about slavery and the colored race, I do because I believe it helps to save the Union. This is how I see my official duty. It does not change my wish as a person that all men everywhere could be free.
President Lincoln failed to keep the question of slavery out of the Civil War. As the war went on, month after long month, people in the North began to see it as more than a struggle for national unity. They began to see it as a struggle for human freedom. Abolitionists were active. In speeches and writings, they said over and over again that slavery was evil. As public opinion began to change, anti-slavery members of Congress gained more power. By the summer of 1862, they had enough support to pass laws ending slavery in Washington, D.C., and United States territories. They also pushed through Congress a bill that would do much to end slavery in the states.
The bill was called the Confiscation Act. It gave the federal government the power to confiscate or seize the property of all persons who supported the Southern Rebellion. Slaves were considered property. So any slaves seized under the Act would become free immediately. Slaves who escaped from rebel slave owners also would be free. The bill would not affect slaves owned by persons who supported the Union. President Lincoln did not like the Confiscation Act. He thought it interfered with his wartime powers as commander-in-chief.
However, Lincoln was under great pressure from abolitionists, so he signed the new law, but he did not plan to enforce it. He still hoped for a plan that would free the slaves slowly, over time. He proposed such a plan, but only for the border states between North and South. Under his plan, the federal government would buy slaves in the border states and free them. Lawmakers from the border states rejected Lincoln's plan, and that is when he decided to issue the Emancipation Proclamation.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.